Hey everybody, Adam Savage in the Armor Conservation Lab at the Metropolitan Museum of Art alongside our friend Sean. How are you, sir?
How you doing? Welcome back.
Thank you so much. I love arms and armor, and one of the things that my association with the Met has brought about is while I love these things, I have not touched original examples of very many of them. Last time I was here, they satisfied that by showing me some gauntlets, and now, Sean, you have a selection of original period swords, and I have been trying not to look down, but oh my God, every single one of these makes me a little choked up.
And I do apologize. I would have loved to have had more, but the table is only so big.
You have eight swords here. I'm having trouble breathing almost seeing these. So these are all period.
Yeah, these are all period pieces.
Yeah.
What we have here in arrayed kind of chronologically.
Okay.
So we've got sort of 13th century. Then up to about 1790 at the end. What we ended up picking to do is really just sort of straight double-edged blades, European.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's wildly different kinds of edged weapons all over the world.
Yeah.
And even within Europe, while you tend to think of the double-edged sword being the classic knightly weapon,
mm-hmm.
there's tons of single-edged swords, curved swords, all manner of things.
Right.
But again, only so much table space, so we're going to start with this. So now I know you've built a couple swords in your day and a couple knives, but just for your viewers here. So here is our 13th century sword, and what I kind of like here is the guard comes back, so you can kind of see how they're constructed.
Right,
so the blade continues. You can grab this.
I can. Oh my
God. The blade continues, narrows then right at where the guard is. It's called the shoulder,
right.
And becomes what's called the tang, which runs through the grip, through the pommel, and then is riveted over the back to seal everything together. Peened over the back. To rivet the thing together.
And so you still, the grip is long gone, but the other bits of furniture are still
attached.
Here.
And you can hold that by the handle if
you really
like.
Can.
Yeah. Ooh. Feel the weight of it.
This is, this right here, this is what I've been wanting so badly. When you buy, replica swords are everywhere.
Yeah.
And they are incredibly plentiful and they're all stamped out of that 440.
Mm-hmm.
And they're way over heavy, blade heavy.
Yeah.
And I knew that these things had a much better balance to them mm-hmm. than you expected, but I didn't expect it to be this light.
Yeah, so this one, and you've lost some material.
Sure, sure.
Was this being excavated?
Yeah, it was excavated.
Yeah, yeah.
So this deterioration of having been buried.
Yeah, you lost a little bit, but not much. So right now this weighs just over a pound and a half. I would be shocked if this even weighed 2 pounds when it was new. So it was a very light sword, and this is, I think, pretty representative. At this time period, you've got, your armor is, for a fully armored man, obviously there's people who are wearing less armor,
mm-hmm.
But you sort of have head-to-toe mail, helmets, and then your torso is protected by something like called a coat of plates, where you've got not a solid breastplate, but larger plates sort of riveted to a textile or a leather liner. So you have some substantial armor, but you're not like head-to-toe in plate armor just yet. One of the things about mail is, it's great against stopping a sword slash. It is a flexible material, so it passes that energy onto the person beneath it.
Things hurt when they hit you, even if they don't
kill
you.
Boy, do they, yeah. I remember hearing about it as a skeleton excavated near York that has a mail ring embedded in the shin. It must have driven the clean through. Yeah, that must have ruined his day.
Ow! Wow.
So this kind of sword, you'd really is suited to that kind of armor and that kind of combat. So then, of course, people start armoring up.
Yeah.
And I think there's a sort of a misconception that after, armor starts and so you start having the sort of thrusting weapons, and then it's a smooth progression then to rapiers.
Mm-hmm.
And you have cutting swords very much in the same vein as the earlier swords continue because not everyone's wearing the same level of armor.
Right.
And even within sort of swords designed for thrusting, there's a tremendous variety. So mm-hmm, we're going to look at a couple of those.
I just holding this and feeling its balance, I'm finding this really quite intoxicating.
Really nice, yeah. Waiting to get to the next one.
Okay.
Of all the feel, it's probably my favorite. So now this is fabulous. So here, you've got the additional length for a second hand
it's a
beyond
hand and
there.
A half.
And we've switched from having the fuller, so that sort of shallow channel mm-hmm, is called a fuller. Mm-hmm. It's to help lighten the weight
it's
without weakening it.
It's not a blood groove.
Not a blood groove.
Moving on.
So this one has the diamond cross section, gives a little more rigidity to the thrust, but here's what I love. All right, grab it. See how much flex you have in there. These were remarkably flexible.
Yeah.
We have some where if you hold it out straight, it'll actually bow a little bit on its own weight. Yeah. So this would have still been a nasty cutter despite being having the diamond cross. Oh yeah, it feels fabulous, right? So this piece is this inscription here is in Arabic.
Yeah.
And it says that this was donated to the Mamluk arsenal in Alexandria in 1419. So the sword has to predate that.
So this was donated to a museum in 1419.
Yeah, it was presumably captured in battle and then donated as a sign of the Mamluk victory.
I can't even conceive. This is maybe 150,000 thick. You know, this maybe 3 millimeters thick.
Mm-hmm.
With a full diamond cross section, which blows my mind. And that peak is really nice.
Mm-hmm. And this is there's another identical one floating around too. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So
probably a large group.
Oh,
originally.
Man, this is. You're right. I mean, the balance of this.
Yeah. You could easily. You have two hands, but you could easily wield that with one hand very comfortably. It balances quite close to the grip. I think the size of the pommel, the width of the blade right at the base there, and the guard really keeps sort of the mass very close to the hand.
What's the total weight of this?
So that is 3 pounds, 10 ounces.
Okay.
Which is not a lot, really.
No, not. And again, the pommel makes it feel much lighter because of the counterweight. All right, I eventually have to let this one go. Okay.
We can come back. So now here's the next
one. And that's 13th century.
So this is very probably very early 14th century.
Okay.
So our end date is 1419. So at some point before then.
Right.
How long it was kicking out before then, we're not sure. So now this one is pretty much contemporary. So this is somewhere between 1400 and 1430, probably made in Germany.
Okay.
Now what you'll notice, this is actually lighter.
Really?
You will not think that.
This
is actually lighter, but get your hands on that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't feel lighter because
like
the balance
crowbar,
is quite different.
Right? So you look at the blade difference, though. So it's the same amount of weight.
Right.
But all compacted in. So you have sort of this flattened hexagon at the base.
Right.
Which then transforms into this really thick diamond cross section.
So this is meant for piercing through.
Through mail, really.
You and the things you're wearing.
Yeah, because by this point, you have really head-to-toe plate armor. And so you can't cut or thrust through an actual piece
slashing
of plate.
Having a lithe weapon is no longer to your advantage.
No, against a heavily armored
man. Right.
So the option is you have to find the gaps. And so those gaps are very often covered with either you having a mail shirt on
mm-hmm.
or sort of a set of mail shorts or just, you know, later on you'll have just an individual patch of mail might be sewn to your jacket,
just
where the gaps are. And so something like this, your goal is to find those gaps and hit those mail rings and split them open. And so you want something that really, this is just a spike with a cross guard on it.
Well, I remember looking at some of the old grappling manuals, the fighting manuals, where this really is specifically, you were using this hand to guide it into those spaces.
Yeah, you're using the sword almost like a spear.
Yeah.
And talking about having mail on the inside of the palm sometimes, we've seen.
Oh, yeah, right, so you could do that.
Yeah, now you can do that. This probably wasn't sharp in the way that you normally think of a sharp sword.
Right.
Maybe just wearing a glove would have been enough. But yeah, having mail on your hands certainly would have helped.
Do I see some evidence of gilding?
I think there's some brass inlay.
Okay.
Inside or on the blade, which might have been maker's marks.
Mm-hmm. Little X's.
Yeah.
And then there's inscriptions down here.
Yeah.
There's
a stamp inside the tang,
mm-hmm.
and then on the other side of the pommel it says Maria.
It says Maria.
Yeah, a little religious inscription.
I can't believe that's lighter than its predecessor.
I know, just the balance is so different. And this one as well, similar weight. And now, what I love is, this is, again, one of my favorite pieces in the collection. You can pick this up.
Oh, wow.
I know, right?
Wow.
So this is, you know, you have all these, this is the same time, or I think probably later. So it's 15th century.
Yeah.
But again, this is not focused on defeating an armored opponent per se.
Okay.
Right? This is, you've got the fuller,
right.
It's a much flatter
right.
blade. Clearly, sort of cutting is a major factor. Mm-hmm. You can thrust as well, of course, but I don't see this as something you're going after a male, you know, splitting male rings open with.
Right. I can hold
absolutely,
it by the...
Absolutely, yeah.
Just not... Oh, then the balance again is really, really,
really nice.
Nice
in the hand. So in during the early Middle Ages, the city of Passau starts making these sort of called running wolf marks.
Oh.
And they become famous for having high quality blades. And so other cities start copying the running wolf mark. So like the city of Solingen at some point is actually making more swords with this running wolf mark than Passau is. So you see that mark. We say, oh, Solingen or maybe Passau, but it really could have been all over because people were literally copying
it. They were, of course they were. Yeah. Now, in these blades, the first one and the third one you've shown have incredible pitting. They were excavated probably. Mm-hmm. This one is in insanely nice condition. Was this on someone's mantelpiece for hundreds of years?
So it's been cleaned at some point.
Okay.
Oh. So I was actually just talking with Pierre about that, where you can kind of tell that it must have been taken apart because you've got a, this is a cool feature too. This is sort of a rain guard.
Yeah.
So this, it was actually quite common. They rarely survive. Would go over the mouth of the scabbard while it was sitting in the scabbard.
Oh.
So you wouldn't get moisture inside.
Nice.
If this was for a couple hundred years next to a steel plate, you would expect to see some corrosion.
But you don't.
You don't. So someone has disassembled this sword,
it was...
cleaned it, put it back together. And they've done a beautiful job.
And that could have happened any time in the last 300 years.
Yeah.
Probably.
This sword... I think it first appears in the 19th century is when we first see it. So, I mean, this could have been done quite some time ago.
Right.
And
back then, they didn't have the same idea of conservation that we do now.
No,
so
no,
they wouldn't think much of taking an old sword and just scrubbing all the rust
off.
Like,
oh, this is all wrong. It should be bright and shiny and knock it apart. You do the same thing with armors. Rip off all the old leathers, throw them in the trash, and get some new stuff.
So you must be able sometimes to look at a picture and be like,
oh. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. And what's great is, like, you'll see this... The leather's only on the top half of that.
Oh, so this isn't part of the grip missing. It's actually intended to be
that way. No, that's actually a metal sleeve. This is the only one I'm aware of that survives. There's, I think, some depictions in artwork where you can see that. If we're looking for a function, it probably adds, much like the pommel, it adds some counterweight to it,
mm-hmm.
is my guess.
Oh, right, it's thicker than a tang.
Yeah, it's just a little extra metal, a little extra weight. But really, we don't know. It could have just been a fashion for that time.
Right, so this is still a sleeve that goes over the tang of the blade, which gets peened down here.
Tang passes all through it, just like as if this was another block of wood.
This is lovely. And the leather of this grip is original.
It looks pretty good to me.
It looks pretty original.
I like you got the... you've got some cord is set in and then wrapped over it, so you have this nice X pattern.
X pattern, and then this beautiful braided copper, it looks like almost.
Yeah, it looks like copper. You do see Turk's head knots on some very old swords. I'm not 100% sure about that particular set of wire.
Yeah.
But we have some excavated swords that are, I mean, they're around. You can see them where you have the mineralized remains of a Turk's head on like the base of the blade.
Wow.
Yeah, it's
wow.
really cool.
Oh, that's cool.
And what I love is, again, same weight as these two, roughly the same time period, but three wildly different examples.
Right.
Now, I want you to pick this up, and I just want you to look it over and tell me what you notice.
Okay. This is weird. So, it's it's shaped like a tongue depressor. it strikes me there's two possibilities. Either it was ceremonial, so it never came out of its scabbard, or it's for... practice, but for someone wealthy.
It is practice for someone very wealthy, yeah. So it's completely blunted,
right.
All the way around.
Right.
The tip's completely rounded off.
So they can't hurt their teacher.
Yeah, you know, or each other. It's a matched set, so we actually have a matching one decorated identically.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and so this is it was made in Munich in 1575, which is really late for this style of sword. Like these you might call sort of long swords or mm-hmm. hand-and-a-half swords, and there's sort of a rich tradition of fencing manuals, like as you were talking about earlier.
Right.
And so in the later period, they have these sort of dedicated training swords, and you'll see these depicted in the fighting manuals, the later fighting manuals. These training swords actually stayed in use, think of it as really a sport or sort of expectations of a gentleman,
right.
Long after this type of sword had actually fallen out of functional use.
Really?
Yeah.
I love the fact that the etching is way off center here. And it's etched to, I don't know if it was originally etched to two different depths, but they definitely mm-hmm. have a very different look to them.
Yeah, you'll sometimes get a differential wear just because of, let's say, how the object was. Let's say this was hung on a wall and one side's
exposed,
cleaned and one side's
yeah,
not.
Yeah. But it's beautiful. Like all the furniture work is really quite lovely.
The combination of the file work and then the etching around it is, I just think, really nice.
Yeah.
Someone really important had these for.
And hopefully got good at using a sword from this.
Yeah, so now we're moving over. I kind of want to talk about these two at once.
Okay.
So now we're sort of really in the era of the rapier. So, right.
But I don't think I've seen a rapier with a blade that fat.
So you do get them. So this might be called a riding sword, would be one term that's used in German. And this is what I quite like about this one. I'll let you hold it. This particular sword. Is what we call like a military issue. So this was purchased and part of the equipment of sort of the personal army of the Elector of Saxony.
Okay.
So we know this is issued, kept in stock in an arsenal for use by a military person.
Gotcha.
And whereas this here is purely civilian. So they're identical weight, exactly the same weight.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They've just sort of put the mass in different areas. So this is clearly primarily for thrust, but you have a stouter blade.
Right.
You can really cut with it. Given the name it's given, the riding sword, it may have been used for cavalrymen.
Right.
As well. But I liked the juxtaposition of a rapier for war and a rapier for civilian use, and I think those things tend to get blurred a bit.
Right. And the for war, it's going to be much less adorned because it doesn't need that decoration.
Yeah. Though you will see gentlemen of that era with civilian, wildly, beautifully decorated civilian rapiers hanging off and the armor.
May I pick this up?
You may pick this up. So you'll notice immediately when you put your finger around the finger ring there, it's not terribly comfortable, is it?
No, it's not. Yeah, you can totally, there's a lot of shit going on, right?
So this is, I think, as far as I'm aware, unique. You have similar chain motifs on different swords, rapiers, but this is the only one where I'm aware of where you have inlaid silver chain and then inlaid silver jewels as well. So we don't really know much about this. It's a bit unusual. I think it's possibly Italian, but I don't think anyone's really sure. But clearly, you've got a perfectly functional blade, and
this
is something
it's
that
a
really
beautiful blade.
You know, would really be for civilian use. Incredibly long, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
The hilt is really predominantly for show.
Right.
You could use this, but it wouldn't even be particularly comfortable to
use.
And this is where you start seeing the shift from swords being, a weapon thing of personal defense, and really start becoming a part of
the fashion.
Now, always people had jeweled, beautiful swords that had a great purpose. But sort of en masse, you really start seeing the sword becoming less about the martial aspects of it and more that a gentleman was expected to have one. And here is our last one. And so this is a small sword made about 1790. Very light.
It weighs nothing.
Yeah.
You could forget it was in your hand.
And that was partially the point, because we've reached this is purely really a costume item. Don't get me wrong, you could do some damage with that if you felt like you could
harm.
But sort of we've crossed the threshold where the primary purpose is sort of, it is a piece of jewelry. And what I love is the beautiful blade. And they are really well designed as thrusting weapons go. So you have this sort of triangular cross-section that also has a fuller on the other side. So very, very light, but also very, very stout.
Yeah.
And then what the reason I picked this one in particular, it's one, it's beautiful, but it's the whole hilt is steel, and
that's
these aren't chiseled. It's blued steel. They're beads that rotate.
No.
Individual little beads. Every single one of these in the entire hilt. Some of them, of course, are stuck.
Yeah.
But every single one of these is designed
to spin.
And the reason we think it is blued in this manner is that it's a mourning sword. When someone has passed away and you're mourning them, you can't wear a flashy, a gold flashy sword.
Yeah.
So you would have a more somber hilt to go with your black mourning clothes.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I can't believe this is steel. I thought it was some sort of glass at first because the blue is so lovely. Funnily enough about the shorter blade, when I had my Inigo Montoya sword, I had a rapier blade made for it. to the correct length of a rapier blade, and then found out that's like 7 inches longer than the ones they use in the movie, because for fight choreography, the one I had made was this long, and in the movie, they're much closer to this long.
Yeah, just easier, I'm sure, to get the shot.
Yeah, you don't need the distance.
I mean, I would argue you don't need this long in combat.
Indeed. I can't believe how light it is. Literally, do you know how much this whole thing weighs?
Yeah, that's, I'm trying to think. I think that's like a pound and a half as well. Oh, no, it's less. That's 16 ounces.
That's just 1 pound.
Just a pound. Sorry, 14 ounces.
It feels like...
Yeah, it feels like nothing.
I've drunk sodas that were lighter than this, heavier than this. Sean, what a thing. I mean, you know, we make stuff, we build stuff for a living, we have our hands wrapped around materials. There's just nothing like holding something that someone made.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, you should get one more.
Oh, yeah, you give me this is how we finish. I just can't. Thank you for bringing me back to this one.
Our pleasure.
This is, again, 14th century. Late 14th century.
Late 15th century.
Late 15th.
Or, sorry, very early 15th century.
Okay. Amazing. All right. I think that's as good a place to stop as any. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.